My name is Lynn Olson. Today's date is July 11, 1986, and the following is an interview with Alvina Storm, SDSU Emeritus Professor of Geography, 1926 to 1966. The interview is a part of the San Diego State University Archives Oral History Project and is being recorded at her home in San Diego.
Well, I'll start some questions going back a little ways. This is the way I usually start the interviews. Where and when were you born?
I was born in Pendleton, Oregon, on March 10th, 1902.
So what, where, Oregon again?
Pendleton, P-E-N-D-L-E-N. No, P-E-N-D-L-E-T-O-N. Pendleton, Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
Both of my parents came to this country from Germany as teenagers or in their early 20s, about a little, well, my father, I guess, came in sometime about 1890, my mother about 1900.
And what did your father do from there?
Well, he was a rancher, and he had done all sorts of things previous to that time. He had worked his way across the country, seeing the country and working in the lumber, working in irrigation projects, working in farm areas, wherever there happened to be a job. Mm-hmm. It was a matter of getting acquainted with the country, seeing it. He had a great curiosity about people and places. And so he worked his way across the country and eventually ended up in Eastern Oregon in a community where there were also quite a number of Germans from that northern area of Holstein.
And how about your mother? Did she work outside?
No. She came directly to that same community with a brother and met my father and was married pretty shortly after she came.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one brother and I have one sister, both alive.
Uh-huh. How about your early education? Did you grow up there in Oregon?
Yes. I started out going to a one-room country school until I was in the sixth grade. And then since we lived in 10 miles from, we lived 10 miles from Pendleton. And because the one-room country school didn't offer much in the way of education, most of the teachers in those days of country schools probably had finished high school, but not more than that. Mm-hmm. And for other reasons, my mother had died, my sister and I went to a small Catholic boarding school in Pendleton, which gave us the opportunity to finish and go through high school.
And the curriculum there was considerably different from what you would get at the other school, of course.
Well, there was no other choice. There was no high school available in the country. You could have gone through the eighth grade. The alternative was a public school in Pendleton, and that would have meant that we would have had to board with somebody. You couldn't go back and forth 10 miles with a horse and buggy. So this made it possible for us to finish high school.
I see. Would have been a boring situation, whichever way you went. You'd have to stay.
You'd have to stay someplace.
Yeah.
And this was a good deal better.
Mm-hmm. When did you become interested in geography?
Probably before I went to school. My father, as I say, had a great deal of curiosity about the world, and he'd seen a fair amount of it. And I can remember playing games with him on a huge wall map that we had in our ranch kitchen, naming states and capitals. Now that isn't, states and capitals isn't very important, but it, I think, did intrigue me. And
it's a basis for...
And I did get interested in maps.
Did you become interested in maps and cartography?
Oh, not particularly cartography, but I just got interested in places. And you learn a lot about shapes of areas from maps, and that's important later on. Mm-hmm. So, but that's probably where I got my start. It was always seemed very simple to me, it always seemed very easy, and I managed to discover at the University of California at Berkeley that there were courses in geography at a college level. So, I tried them.
You became interested in geography at a very early age, and that continued on through your education.
Right.
And then you decided when you were going to school to go into geography.
Well, I didn't decide that until I was probably about a junior. I didn't know that there were courses in GRE. I discovered them. I remember I was quite surprised when I saw in the catalog that there were courses available. And I think probably it was in my junior year. And I enrolled in some of them and found them very interesting, so I stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. And that was at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. I noticed that many of the people that I've interviewed so far all went to Berkeley.
Well,
was
if
that
you go
because
back
that was the only
to,
UC no, campus? Or
well, I don't know the answer to that. I think probably yes. I don't know when UCLA got started. Do you? But I think it was a good deal later than that. It was the school in California. See, that was a long time ago. Well, I guess Stanford existed, yes. But Stanford was an expensive private school. In terms of public school, I think there was a university, and then there were, of course, some teachers' colleges. I think that there was a teachers' college at UCLA, which preceded the UCLA branch mm-hmm. as it exists today.
Mm-hmm. When did you receive your degrees?
I received a BA in 1924 and a master's in 1927.
Directly on?
That's it. Mm-hmm. I did not go for a PhD.
Mm-hmm. Why did you not go for a PhD?
Well,
I was debating whether or not to ask you that.
No, it's perfectly simple. Carl Sauer, with whom I did my work, suggested that I do that. By that time, it was roughly 1930. And 1930 was a time when it was pretty hard to find two nickels to rub together. That was part of the story. I also knew that I liked to teach, and that's what I wanted to do. And I decided that whatever time I had could much better be spent doing research and field work for my courses rather than to go in for a thesis of some kind.
Even though you would have the option of doing research for your courses later on? Do you think about it that way?
Well, no. You need to do them while you're giving your courses. Mm-hmm. And especially in those early days, most of us had to teach a lot of different things because the faculty was small. So you were called upon to do something, and you didn't feel you really were prepared for it. So you spent a lot of time mm-hmm. while you were teaching that course, the first couple of years, digging out the material. I also decided that I would prefer to get married and have a family, and that I couldn't see that a PhD was going to do me a lot of good. To be sure, I could have got it would have meant more salary, but I was not interested in writing. There was no particular one thing that I wanted to research. I had a position that I thought I would like to continue in. I didn't have any aspiration to go teach someplace else. And so it worked out well.
Now, you moved to San Diego specifically because of the teaching job.
Yes, when I got through, when I had a year of graduate work, I needed a job. I wanted a job. And Carl Sauer, who was my major professor, was responsible for my, he was the one who recommended me because they had asked here for someone in geography. Mm-hmm. And so I was very happy to take the job.
And that was after you had received your degrees then?
Well, no, I hadn't gotten my, that was in 1920, let's see.
26.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get my degree until 27. But I knew that I was going to get it.
How did you work out getting your degree from Berkeley when you were teaching down here?
Well, I had had 1 year of graduate work. I'd had most all, I hadn't had, I finished the coursework.
Okay.
I finished the coursework, that's, yeah. And all I had to do was to get my thesis material. And I decided I wanted to write my thesis on the historical geography of San Diego. So the material was all here. Mm-hmm. It meant working weekends and evenings and vacations and that sort of thing. But this was my field.
You did it very quickly, considering you were teaching full-time also.
Well,
a lot of work, a lot of weekends,
yes.
A lot of evenings.
Yes.
When you came to San Diego, I noticed also in this yearbook here and in other early ones, you were Miss Soul.
Soul.
Sewell.
S-U-H-L.
S-U-H-L. When did you get married?
34.
And did the man you marry have anything to do with San Diego State, or did he work?
No.
Something completely
no.
different?
He was teaching in the city schools and continued to teach in the city schools until he retired. No. The town was small in those days. I don't know what the population was. It was something under 100,000 people. And many of those, he had come to San Diego, I think, 6 months earlier. In those first few years, most of my associations were with teachers. I taught a year in the public schools here before I went to the college. So I got acquainted with a lot of them. And a lot of the other public school teachers were new to the area, so we all banded together. And so we got acquainted with a lot of people in the city schools.
Uh-huh. And well, also considering where you were teaching, it's also a teacher's college.
Yes.
I would imagine that would have some influence also on your association with the schools.
Well, that was true, because a lot of our students were headed for teaching, and many of them taught in the city schools. And so, but the town, say, was small enough that we knew a lot of people. I mean, you knew a lot of the teachers. You knew them through somebody else who taught someplace and taught someplace else. And then,
do you recall, what school did your husband teach at?
Oh, he taught at Horace. No, not my 18. I think his first years were at Memorial Junior High School.
Is that right?
And then he also taught at Horace Mann. He taught in Linda Vista. I don't know what that was called. That was during the war. He taught at Dana the last years.
Quite a few.
No, I don't know if it's any place else or not. I can't remember. No, I'm sure. I think those were that was because he taught in junior high school all of that time. Possibly, I don't know if the Memorial was a junior, senior high school or not. And I'm not sure about Linda Vista, because Linda Vista during the war, just grew up out of nowhere.
Grew fast, yeah.
They taught in the bungalows, in the houses, they had no separate building of any kind. And I don't remember, honestly, whether there was a senior or high school or not. But mostly his specialty was junior high school students.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to skip back a little bit and ask you about your teaching experiences before you started at San Diego.
I had had a number. My first teaching experience was after my sophomore year in college. I wanted money, and I also wanted to be sure that I wanted to teach. So I went back to Eastern Oregon, where I had been brought up, and took the state examination. You could get a credential by taking a state examination.
All that was needed was an examination?
If you could pass that examination, right. But I had taken, I'm not too sure, I can't remember for sure. I think I'd taken a course in psychology or maybe something of that kind. I'd taken a course, I think, in educational psychology. I'd nibbled at some of those courses that dealt in that field. I passed the exam, and I was, believe it or not, a prize teacher because I had some college work. And as I said before, most of the one-room skilled teachers had finished high school, and some of them had not even finished high school. So with a college degree, I could command what was at that time considered one of the best schools, and it happened to be on the Indian reservation close by, which also paid the most, a small consideration.
Do you remember the name of the Indian Reservation?
Yes. It's the Umatilla Indian Reservation. U-M-A-T-I-L-L-A.
Wait, start over again.
U-M-A-T-T-I-L-A. That's what it is. When you make me spell it so slowly, I'm not too sure.
I bet you that your teaching experiences of that at the reservation. Might make a couple of
That spelling is wrong. It's one T and two L's.
Oh, I've got one also. U-M-A-T-I-L-L-A.
That's right.
All right.
As I say, when you make me spell them out loud, I'm lost.
You probably have some pretty good recollections of your teaching?
Yes, it was. It was. Well, I think I was all of 19, and I didn't know any better. You know, at that age, there isn't anything you aren't willing to try.
I'm kind of naive. You don't want to learn.
I did have a better background than a lot of the teachers, and that I knew. I had a rather formidable task. I think there were at most 26 youngsters. Now, they were not 26 all the time, because some of the older boys, particularly, only came during the winter months when they were not needed to work on the ranches. Mm-hmm. I had some full-blooded Indians. I had some half-breeds. I had all Caucasian. I had everything from the first grade through the eighth grade, but not, I've forgotten, there were two grades missing, like 5 and 7 or something. And they ranged in age from 6 to about 19. I think maybe one of those boys was older than I at the time. But it was not too far from town, and the superintendent of schools, the county superintendent of schools, was very helpful. I had taken a summer school at Pendleton, the extension from the University of Oregon, before I went to teaching. 6 weeks, very intensive course. Mm-hmm. So as I say, you know, when you're young and you don't know any better, you just go ahead and do it.
But it was a good experience for you?
Oh yes, it was really very good. We for those days we had beautiful equipment. We had a forced heat furnace, which burned the school down eventually. I mean, it was, you know, those little furnace out here with pipes that force the air over into the large room. We had a 3-burner coal oil or kerosene stove on which we could heat soup for augment lunches. We had a very generous board, and we had also very complete vacuum board.
How did you manage to instruct students that ranged in age?
Well,
you
didn't
buy
every grade didn't have every subject every day. You can imagine that. Also, some of the older ones helped with the younger ones. Sometimes you could combine them. You know, they might, fifth grade might be reviewing something that the fourth grade was doing.
Get them started on a task and let them go.
They did a good deal of work on their own. It's nice. Some of the older students helped the younger ones. I don't remember too well. But the three little girls that I had in the first grade, two finished college eventually, so they weren't ruined completely. And most of them were pretty eager to learn. There were practically no discipline problems.
That's good. I was going to ask you how you were accepted, if you had plenty of respect for
students.
There
was no problem whatsoever. There were occasionally feuds among the, but there was no problems, and the teachers, at least I think in that district, had the backing of the parents, and the children knew it. So your word was pretty well law. It was no.
That's good.
Kids will be kids. So they tried little things from one kind or another, but it was not much of a problem. Most of them, the older ones, were very eager to go to school and very glad to have the opportunity. And they say they were very cooperative. Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting experience.
How long again were you there? 1 year?
Just 1 year. Mm-hmm. By that time, I decided I wanted to teach. I also questioned whether I wanted to teach elementary work. My next teaching experience was as a teaching fellow at the university, mm-hmm. which I did for 2 years. And then I taught 1 year in the public schools here at Roosevelt Junior High School.
Yep. Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
And that convinced me I did not want to teach junior high school. My husband loved every junior high school student. And the only thing I can say, I'm just glad my own son survived that period. I think it's a very difficult time.
You have to have
a special kind of talent. And God knows it's a very, very important time. But
it takes an awful lot of patience.
It takes patience and understanding that I don't think I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you decided not to, because you decided that you did not want to go into junior high school teaching, did that also preclude anything earlier than that?
I think so, yes, pretty much. I had taught college students at Berkeley, and I knew I liked that.
You like that a lot more, huh?
Even as a teaching assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, well, there's a long story behind it. Originally, I was to go directly to the teacher's college, but there wasn't money. And so I got an offer to teach for a year in the city schools while the other job gradually opened up, as it were. But I like college students. Mm-hmm. I still like college students.
Did you ever hold down any other kind of a job other than teaching?
Oh, no. I did do a few odds and ends during summer school when I was in college. Mm-hmm. Not really. No.
I guess we better get on to San Diego now. You've got a unique perspective of having taught at the old normal school and also at the new campus, Mission Palisades campus. What were your first impressions of the normal school when you arrived in 1926? Any overall aspect?
No, I don't think so. I knew pretty well what it was going to be like. And it was of course a relatively small school. I can't tell you how much enrollment was. It was a very personal sort of a place. We had one big building, which of course is gone. I don't suppose. Have you lived in San Diego?
Yes.
Do you know what that building used to look like?
Yes. I've seen many pictures.
It looked like the old Greek temple.
Yeah.
That was it. Well, behind it was another building. Behind it was the elementary school, the training school, which is still there. That building is still there, I think. But I liked it right from the beginning. We were very close to students.
Students then, of course, were they younger
no,
in age than they are now?
I don't think so. I don't think so. They were not much different than students are today. They had all the same traits, I think, except that we knew them somewhat better. We saw a lot of them because a lot of the students, well, as today, had organizations of one kind, either social or departmental. Mm-hmm. And each one had to have a faculty advisor. And so
and they went to see that faculty advisor, whereas
yes,
nowadays.
And you went to their meetings, a lot of them. Also, every social function had to have a chaperone.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw them at night in their social life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, you got much better acquainted with them, of course. Their classes were, well, they're still a pretty good size. I'm not sure, I can't remember for sure, but it seems to me that even my earliest beginning class in geography probably had 50 or 60 people, and maybe more. I'm trying to think what those old classrooms looked like.
I would imagine
we
would have had
really. We had pretty good size. You see, this was one of the things that happened in the 30s. Well, of course, it had not yet started when I first went there. Was that many of the students came to the State College. Many of them went for 2 years and then transferred someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Talking about the.
About
students.
Yeah. And we were all very close together, we were very crowded. Things haven't changed in that respect. I had an office in the upstairs. That building had a stairway that went from the front door, up to the second level.
Mm-hmm.
And on that second level, there was a very sizable hallway. And a couple of us had our offices there. No walls, we just had a desk.
In the hallway?
That's right, that was it. Well, practically. And this went on. Until we moved in 31.
Uh-huh.
The place was very, very full of people.
Very crowded.
Mm-hmm.
Not a whole lot of room to spread out your research.
No, we stored our maps in Miss Clark's office. She was the other member of the department with whom I worked. We carried our equipment, like a projector and slides, from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
And
do you recall who was in the department with you when you first arrived?
Oh, yes.
There was Vinnie Clark.
That was it.
That was it.
She was the only one.
When did McIntyre and Blake come on?
Oh, Blake was there a good part of that time, and he was only there for a course, for a single course, because he was the weather man. The weather,
meteorologist.
Yeah, in the Weather Bureau.
Oh,
so he was not. I don't know what his status was on the campus. He was he probably was called a lecturer. I'm not too even sure about that. But he came, he had a course. And I don't know, you'd have to go back in the archives to find that. Now McIntyre taught, did he take one course in geography? He was really not a member of our department. I think he belonged to engineering or something else.
He might have been in, I noticed that a number of courses were taught within the geography sphere of geography, meteorology, weather reporting, things like that. Possibly he was involved in that in some way. Not
I can see the man, but I've forgotten what he taught. What yearbook have you got there?
I think I have 1931. I have this here for a specific reason. There you are. I remember if these two people are in this
book. I rather doubt it. Now, McIntyre, maybe so, because it seems to me that he taught a class, but what it was, I don't know. He wasn't there very long.
Okay. Well, I can find that
you
out.
You can find that out.
Yeah.
Really, the first person who came who taught any number of courses was Baylor Brooks, and he taught some geography, just as I had taught, at least claimed to have be teaching a course in geology, which I was very happy to. That was the sort of thing. I had a lot of geomorphology at college. As I say, we had to teach whatever was needed. One of the things that was happening, too, was that we were expanding the credentialing. We were expanding programs of all kinds. So you were always in that bind. You had to have the course in order to take care of the students. You had to have a certain number of students, or otherwise you couldn't finance the course. So it was a...
It's kind of a two-way process here when you're trying to develop the curriculum.
That's right. And it can be very, very difficult, especially when money is scarce and the state says, no, you can't have any money unless you have 10 students or whatever in the course.
Did you find, because of that, that you were doing a lot of teaching of courses, which was above and beyond the call of duty? Were you teaching courses?
Oh,
that were
yes.
This
happened.
Allocation?
This happened every now and again. We would need to have a new course, and we would decide we would offer it. And I taught courses for nothing. I mean, they were simply added to your load.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us did it willingly because it wasn't going to last forever. And it was one way to take care of the students who needed the courses for whatever reason. It was also one way to gradually build up what we could offer for all kinds of students.
I noticed quite a variety of offerings in one of the catalogs that I looked at. Quite a number of courses offered, and only a few names of instructors are nice.
Right.
That's an awful lot for one instructor to carry.
I don't know. It seems to me, as I look back now, much of the time we taught 14 or 15 hours a week. I think when I taught more than that, I couldn't prove it. I'd have to go back somehow and look at the records. But there were times when we carried very heavy loads and we carried very large enrollments. The students were there, they came, and you had to take care of them. And worked out all right. I mean, okay, you had an overload for a semester or however long, and the state said, okay, you can hire another faculty member. But that's the way you came by them. You had to have some evidence that there was a need and that there were students thirsting for your knowledge in order to get another course on the books. So we did all sorts of things. It was a full-time job, believe me.
Yeah, more than a full-time. What decades saw the greatest growth?
Oh, I guess the influx after the Second World War, that swamped us. We had a pretty steady increase all through the 30s, and the 30s, to my way of thinking, as I've often described them, were the golden years, because, let's say from about 33, it took us a couple of years after we moved to get the rest of the buildings painted, and to get sidewalks, and to get a lot of things done. And we had a fair